now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from classic cults on the cheese in between. The movie's B, but the entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti. Joined by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Good morning, Jason. Today we have another retro film from 30 years ago, The Crow.
And we'll get to it right after this.
People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul. The land of the dead. But sometimes, just sometimes, the crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
You're all going to die.
Is that gasoline I smell?
Victims, aren't we all?
The Crow was released, it was released May 10th, 1994 in Santa Monica, and then it had its national release May 13th, 1994 with a 102-minute running time. Your director here is Alex Piraeus. Now, Alex Piraeus, many people would know, he also went on to direct Dark City in 1998, which is another film that most people, I mean, if you know what it is, you love it. If you never heard of it, you know, he went on to be more known. I, Robot was a much bigger film for him, along with Knowing, you know. So, and he also did the Gods of Egypt, which some people, you know, it's just hard to hear that movie. That because the soundtrack is literally so loud that it overpowers everyone speaking because it's just, and I thought maybe it was my TV. So I turned I turned it as if I'm hard of hearing. So I turned the background noise. Still, the music is so loud and they're whispering in half the movie.
Yeah, and the music just, it
overpowers the whole thing.
But it's on the whole time.
Yeah, it never stops. Yeah.
Well, I've said that many times now. It seems like movies, even dramas, the music is in the background the entire time. And you wind up having an issue with some of the spoken word.
Yeah, well, that's why now the TVs have settings designed to mute that out and mute it, to lower it down, like it used to be. Your screenplay credits go to David J. Shaw and John Shirley, but we all know that this is based on The Crow by James O'Barr. Now, we met James O'Barr at not New York Comic Con. What was the one across the street at the Garden, from the Garden at the New York, not the New York Hotel, the hotel. it's not, was it the Big Apple or something like that? Yeah, Big Apple Comic-Con. We met him there. And I got his autograph and everything. It was really cool to meet him, signing copies of the book and stuff like that. Producers were Edward R. Pressman and Jeff Most. Now, your music here, the actual music is Graham Revell, although this movie is really known for its soundtrack, which I'll talk about after. The soundtrack of this movie is considered to be one of the greatest soundtracks of all time, up there with movies like Singles and even Empire Records and stuff like that, just for the songs that it brings together. But unlike some other movies, Singles was a grunge. It was Singles is a just a poor movie, and the soundtrack's amazing. The difference is, often when it has a really great soundtrack, the movie doesn't keep up. And this one is one of the few movies where people have considered that the soundtrack's amazing and the movie is still considered to be a classic. Of course, your main star here is the late Brandon Lee, who we know would pass away during the filming of this in an accidental shooting on set. Ernie Hudson and Michael Wincott are your other two main stars that you would know. Tony Todd's in there. There's a bunch of other character actors, a lot of character actors you would know. But this movie wasn't marketed on, hey, come see this Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. Hey, come see this Sylvester Stallone movie. It's like Brandon Lee as the Crow. And Brandon Lee, of course, was not super famous. I think he had done Showdown in Tokyo. I'm trying to remember the other ones that were kind of more known, but he had not done a lot of known work. But he's obviously known for being Bruce Lee's son. And obviously Brandon Lee was alive. Obviously he knew his dad, but he was very young when his father was killed. So he had done, where is he? I'm trying to find. Showdown in Little Tokyo was the one from 91, Rapid Fire in 92. And then there's footage of him. And this was very controversial. In 2000, there was footage, in Sex, Lies, and Video Violence, that was released of him. He's a man standing in line at a club, and they made a big deal about, this is Brandon Lee's last movie, and people thought it was in really bad taste because it's in really freaking bad taste. They had a shot of him from this thing they were filming that died off, and they just used this piece and it's him standing in a line. And at the time, I remember this, it was very, very controversial. They were going to do it, which is what they were trying to do. You have a movie that no one cares about, no one's seen ever, but if you can make some controversy, you make create some cash. It just pissed a lot of people off, is what it did. Your production company were Entertainment Media Investment Corporation, Pressman Films, Jeff Moth Productions. Of course, that makes sense that they're your producers. Your distribution is by Miramax Films and Dimension Films. This is one of the early Dimension stuff. In fact, most people, if they ever remember that Dimension having something, people knew what Miramax was, but Dimension, The Crow is what made them. Their VHS of The Crow got them noticed. That, and then Scream. Scream was another big one. And I remember, so this is obviously 94. So I was in college, and The Crow kind of, so this is May of 94. So it's 96, The Crow had kind of was still really big when I was in college. When I was in college, on you had all kinds of posters on your walls. Like I had Pulp Fiction, and I had, John Belushi from Animal House and stuff like that. But a lot of people had Reservoir Dogs on their walls. And people had The Crow. And when you would go to the poster sale, because they would always, Albany would have a giant poster sale at the podium you get there and you buy these posters for like $5, $6, whatever. They would have huge, like mural size ones of Brandon Lee sitting there in the chair. They had giant ones of Reservoir Dogs, the scene where Harvey Keitel is pointing the gun at Tim Roth, right? Where they got the gun at each other, right? Those were the things that I vividly remember all through college, how many people I knew had these on their, just covering their entire walls, my posters up, I had whatever, kind of things on the wall, I had Kathy Ireland and stuff like that, because that's what you used to do back in the day. But I vividly remember one of my friends, Jessie, she had from floor to ceiling, it was like bigger than a bed sheet, and it was Brandon Lee sitting in the chair, and it literally was the entire wall of her room.
And nobody would sell the posters.
100%. 100%.
Smart move.
They're smart. Because I get, and they had that. They had the guy who would sell you the hemp made everything. He would sell you the shirts made from hemp with the big weed symbol on it. And that was sold like crazy up there. You got to remember, folks, it's the 90s. We didn't have, the internet was still new. We didn't have phones. No one documented what we did. But on campus, they would have a guy selling Adidas is made from hemp and all shirts made from hemp and stuff like that. And then next to him was the poster guy. And I'm not saying they all worked for Albany, but Albany had to get some kind of kickback on this. And this guy sold posters. They were $5 a piece and they were everything you could. But he didn't have like cutesy, like a unicorn and a rainbow. It wasn't little kid posters. They were stuff that college kids wanted. You had DMX. You had like by Pulp Fiction. That's where I got my Pulp Fiction poster. Texas Chainsaw Massacre poster, right? Evil Dead. They had horror stuff. They had all you name it. I mean, Spencer Gift used to have those things too, but you go there and, but the Reservoir Dogs, the number of Reservoir Dogs posters, I didn't put up a Reservoir Dogs poster till I got older. Cause I had never seen Reservoir Dogs. I'd seen Pulp Fiction, but the number of people who had Reservoir Dogs on their door was unbelievable. And then the Crow poster of him just walking with which came the cover of the VHS and all this stuff like that. That poster was everywhere. And then him sitting in the chair, near the end of the movie, when he's sitting in the chair at the long table, That's very iconic. Anyway, so, budget for this was $23 million and the box office was $94 million. So a movie that has now become, I don't know what it's now taken in worldwide because this movie has become a phenomenon. Like the Crow is still beloved to this day. It is 30 years old. 4K Steelbook comes out. They sell out immediately. Like, it is on every single Halloween. It is on every single, like, well, more likely on Devil's Night on the 30th. This is a movie that people, I got to watch. It became a movie I watch every year on Devil's Night. It became a habit we just got in the habit of watching. It's a movie that I know I've seen at least 20 to 25 times over the course of whatever kind of thing, all the way through. It's movies that when you catch it, you watch it. It's hard to describe this because it was just a nothing little, you know, comic book movie when comic book movies were not anything. This is before Blade made comic book movies a viable, well, really Blade 2 really made comic book movies viable moneymakers. And I know people will argue, well, it's because of Iron Man, whatever. Yes. But without Blade and then eventually Blade 2, that's with what's his face? The guy, Ron Perlman's in it. Remember, he's the bald guy. That's with the Reapers where their mouths open and stuff. Guillermo del Toro kind of thing, right? That movie took off. And that allowed people to say, hey, maybe I can make some money making, because Batman was 88, right? And the Batman movies were what they were, but the original Batman, you could never catch lightning in a bottle again. That was just Tim Burton and Michael Keaton and everyone was, I mean, even in spite of Kim Basinger, like you literally, that movie was just, okay, that's an iconic film. But they never were able to recapture that until Marvel and then eventually Disney bought them out. Now they produce them and they're designed to make, they cost whatever, but not all of them make the same return on investment. But comic book movies were not necessarily a bankable thing. Remember, Teenage Mutant Turtles, the movie was with the guys in the suits and stuff. It was fine. And I liked it because I was a kid and it had a sequel, but that wasn't mainstream, like major stuff. Movies were not comic books. You know, you didn't produce a comic book or a graphic novel to say, wow, this is going to become a movie, you know? And The Crow is one of those cases where it did work and it worked really well. And this is what led to, I know it's down the road a lot, but why eventually people took a chance on like Sin City and they took a chance on V for Vendetta and they took a chance on those. Why? Because if you have ever read Sin Cities, and yeah, you've read Sin City and stuff, they're great on the screen, their movies there, but they're, you read in this comic going, okay, this isn't like safe. This isn't fun. This isn't pleasant. It's dirty and grimy. But the way it looks, black and white with the little pops of color, it's visually stunning, but it's certainly not all ages. It's certainly not okay for kids. Like, I mean, it's about, you know, prostitution and drugs and killing. And then V for Vendetta as a graphic novel is just harsh, you know, kind of thing. It's got a story to tell, but the movie, both those movies capture it well, their source material. Which is why eventually I think some people, we don't need to get into Watchmen, but some people were disappointed with Watchmen, even though I liked Watchmen. In fact, you watch the extended cut, it's even better. But some people had read the comic so long ago, they never went back and revisited the comic. I didn't read the comic originally because I was too young. I read the comic and then saw the movie and I could see the differences. But to me, you know, Watchmen itself is very much a product of its time. And reading Watchmen with a today slant on it, the 2024 slant on it, doesn't work as well as the 1980
right.
very yeah. different world.
Yeah.
You know, the same way I think Rambo doesn't work the same. The like if you were to read the original First Blood, read the book First Blood, that's very much a product of its time. We are no longer, Vietnam is not something we talk about or know about. It wasn't in our living room. But if you're of a certain generation, when you read First Blood, that's a really hard book because it's about a guy coming home who's not, I mean, First Blood's whole story is just heartbreaking. But I think people, that movie doesn't hit as hard with now because we're so desensitized to a lot of things. And we don't know, and not that we, but like the current generations, they don't have no idea. They have no clue about what's happening, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so. You had to be, you know, coming home from the war was it's not like they do at Yankee Stadium where they, in the bottom of the seventh,
yeah.
they have some veteran from either the Korean War.
Well, the guy the other day was turning 100.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so they thank you for your service.
Yeah.
That was impossible
yeah.
to do
yeah.
back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I remember, it didn't bother me. I never wore. One of the things you didn't do was you didn't keep your uniform out. I mean, when I would wear my field jacket, which was always tremendously good in the wintertime, you know, you wind up taking your name off so that you look like you just got it from either the homeless shelter or, you know, some other, you know, goods place. But yeah, it was a problem back in the mid to late 70s.
Yeah. So. All right, so let's get back to actually the the Crow. No, so let's talk about this up front because it has to be talked about. Brandon Lee was fatally shot when the prop gun during filming had finished most of the film. The film was completed though. They had a stunt double and some digital effects to fill in where they needed. After his death, Paramount Pictures, which originally had opted the film for distribution, backed out. Miramax picks up the rights. The film is of course dedicated, we know, to Brandon Lee and his fiance Liza Hutton. It came out, it became, I don't know. I mean, The Crow just like was different. It was so different than people, but it led to Crow City of Angels in 96, Salvation in 2000, and Wicked Prayer in 2005. The sequels, which have all different actors and none of the original cast, never caught on. Never. Kirsten Dunst is in one of them. Like this, it just never caught on. And now there's the reboot that's coming out in 2024 Skarsgård, Bill Skarsgård, right? Yeah, the one who played Pennywise.
Yeah.
And not here to talk about that. I don't really want to, again, you have form your own opinions. As of this recording, I have not seen it. I know some people swear they will never see it. But by the same token, though, they've taken there's nothing that's sacred anymore. There's no sacred cow. There's nothing that can't be taken and, you know, redone and recut and whatever. And whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, like somebody had to back it. It had to get through enough stages of, I mean, we're getting another Hellboy for some reason that looks way. So the original two Hellboys are great. Ron Perlman as Hellboy himself he looks the part. And David Harbour, if we had never seen Ron Perlman, probably would have been acceptable as Hellboy, but you just like, okay, it's kind of bad. This new one, he looks like god awful. And having read lots of Hellboy stuff, you're like, I don't understand why. No, I know why they're making it, because Hellboy is still a property that they feel they have money in the franchise, but just stop.
Yeah.
Or here's one. Ron Perlman offered to come back. He said he'd take the role, put him back in the movie, because then you get at least some goodwill. People are like, oh, it's Ron Perlman again, right? This is what people's problem is. If Brandon Lee had not been killed during this, I'm not saying The Crow still wouldn't be good, but I don't know if the legend of this movie would ever, and it's horrible to say that, but the legend would never be as big as it is. His death has created so much buzz and so much attention that you couldn't get from just
the movie. Well, think about it. Had he not died and they had a sequel, right? It would have been
But the thing is, he couldn't come back in the sequel. And that's when we get to the movie we'll talk about. Like, when this movie ends, this is a standalone. Like, he can't come back.
Right.
It's not like, I'm coming back to avenge the same. He already avenged them. The whole point is The Crow had to be a different person.
But you could see them having a little different bent on The Crow is now an avenging angel for other.
But here's the problem is, but that's not The Crow. You would then be isolating too many people with what it is. Making the sequels the way they did, where it's somebody who's righting a wrong, they were hoping that was what brought people in. The problem was what brought people into this movie. I mean, Brandon Lee was a very young actor. He wasn't like he was some, it wasn't like it was Brad Pitt or something like that who had made a whole lot of stuff at this point, right? But he was a young actor. They were hoping to get to make him a star because they thought he could be a bankable star. You don't have any other stars in this movie who are like bankable name. No. There's no Mel Gibson's. There's nobody. There's no and Robert De Niro's here, right? It's, I mean, Ernie Hudson was in, most people, honestly, most people know him from Ghostbusters, right? You know, kind of thing. And Michael Wincott, you've seen 100 different places, but you probably don't know him as a star because he's not a star in any movie.
No, and he plays the ghost.
He plays the villain every time. Every time. Right, which is what he needs to play. But anyway, so let's get into this. So here we go. All right. On Devil's Night, which is the 30th of October, in a crime-ravaged and decrepit Detroit. Okay, hang on a second. Let me start. This is 94 Detroit, so 92, 93 Detroit. Detroit now is, and I'm sorry if you're from Detroit, but like, good God. Like, every time they rank the worst places in America, Detroit is like one. And it's hard. So for those who have never seen Don't Breathe, watch Don't Breathe. And I know there's some parts of Don't Breathe that are so hard, especially the end, like when the, you know what I'm talking about, like at the end with the women in captivity and stuff. That's about Detroit, and there's a house, and the guy's like, it's a blind guy living there, and Stephen Lang is amazing, isn't that right? But like, when you watch that, you're like, what? This can't be real. This can't be what Detroit looks like. It is.
It is.
Barbarian explores, this is what Detroit looks like. It doesn't look like America. It looks like a third world nation.
In certain,
but at some points, right. And then other points, it's posh and, you know, exactly. Whatever.
Well, so that's the Detroit is the have and have nots.
Yeah. And there's no middle ground.
There is no middle ground.
And it's, and I go, some people say, oh, I'm from Detroit, but they're not really from Detroit proper. They live in the suburbs or something like that. That's a different story. But you go in there, once the automotive industry left, Detroit became just a wasteland. And it's horrible to say that because again, it's still, I know people live there and whatever, but you look at like what's happening and how many streets are just abandoned, boarded up, burnt out. Like it's just, you're like, how can this be America? How can this be the same country where an hour down the road is multi-million dollar houses? Like, how can this be? But I think, unfortunately, that actually is America. That's more of this country in a nutshell than all the, you know, Mickey Mouse on one side, Down Duck on the other crap. You know,
what's happening now in Detroit with all of those blocks after block after block of just dilapidated homes is that one by one, they go in and they renovate it. They make a big show on TV that they're putting a new, but that family is still living with the rest of the block.
Yeah.
So until they do,
they have to go in and buy up an entire block, buy it all, and then tear it all down, right, and then build it all. Like they would. Like, so when we have like a housing thing go up, like they buy a lot of land and they start building all the houses, right? If you bought a land, knocked everything, and cleared that all out, the problem is the next street over, is crime and everything else. So there has to be. Instead of taking care of the problem when it became a little tiny problem, they let the problem fester and infect everything and get so big. It's just, and that's one of the things that when you watch The Crow, because you're looking at like a city that's kind of, I mean, some people have said, it looks like Seattle because it's always raining. And I'm like, right. But the whole point is supposed to be dark and grungy and dirty. This is not real Detroit at this time.
Right. But the thing with The Crow, the dark and dingy.
It has to be.
It has to be. Yeah. And that's one of the, In essence, it's one of the problems. You've got to have a good copy because it is so dark in certain spots. You really can't even make out what is going on.
Yeah.
The figures and all that. And that's like when you talked about Sin City, that's what I equated it to. Sin City is exactly that. And except when there's those pops of color, Sin City is as dark as this movie.
Right.
But it's black and white. Right. It's like 300. It's cartoonish in spots and yet it looks real.
Yeah.
And so, but again, it's a different way of making a movie.
Yeah. So, all right. So, on Devil's Night, in a crime ravaged and decrepit Detroit, a young woman, Shelley Webster, is raped and seriously wounded while her rock musician fiance, Eric Draven, is shot and thrown to his death from the window of their loft apartment. Police Sergeant Daryl Albrecht, Ernie Hudson, accompanies Shelley to the hospital, but she eventually dies from her injuries. A narration states that the legend of a crow that carries the souls to the land of the dead. If the person died in a tragic circumstance, the crow can resurrect that restless spirit to set things right. So the beginning of this movie, not pleasant. There's a lot in this movie that's not very pleasant. But see, the problem is nowadays it's tame.
Right. Yes.
In 94, this is a TV show today. Yeah. Well, yeah, right. Like Gotham is as grind is, you know, as, you know, gritty as this, right? In fact, Gotham's on regular TV. You get to cable. This is nothing. This is nothing. The boys put the this looks like a child's romp compared to the crap we see on The Boys, just for the vulgarity and disgustingness of what you see. This is disgusting at times because, I mean, they don't, thank God, they don't show you the entire rape and the entire beating, because, I mean, this is not I Spit on Your Grave, but it's like, it's just so like, you're like, oh, really? Like, and in 94, that would have taken people like, oh, really? That like would have bothered people. So 1 year later, Shelley and Eric's graves are visited by Sarah, a young girl the pair cared for due to her absent mother. A crow lands on Eric's gravestone and taps on it, resurrecting him. Disoriented and distressed, Eric returns to his ravaged loft apartment and experiences flashbacks of the murders. A gang of men, Tintin, Funboy, T-Bird, and Skank, targeted the pair. I'll get to that in a minute. Targeted the pair because they were protesting forced evictions in the apartment building, while the gang's leader, Ruthless Cunning Boss Top Dollar, intended to seize. So this is something I think speaks to people. And this is why I think this movie still comes back. People are, you know, it's hard. People are having a hard time, you know, making rent and whatever. Not that there's like gangs pushing them out, but like the gang now is the bank. The gang now is not a bunch of thugs with what is the police? Do any of your bad guys have grown up names? Right. Because it's T-Bird and Top Dollar and whatever. Like they but they're gang members, and making them gang members and gang members that are every color of the rainbow. Let's say like that. They're not all drug addicts. I mean, they're drug addicts, but they're like, one guy's all about like going to be like, one guy's a tweaker. One guy's a heroin addict. One guy's is ripping off old ladies and stealing purses. Like, they're just despicable people. There's nothing likable about any of them, which is what they were going for. So, realizing that any injuries he suffers are immediately healed, Eric dons a black and white face paint and sets out to avenge himself and Shelley, guided by the crow. Now, Eric's the crow makeup became very, very famous later on. Sting would eventually become Crow Sting. It became way bigger than this. Some people didn't even know it was from the crow because people, you know, didn't know all this stuff. But that makeup, you to this day, if you rub some white paint on your face and put the black lines down your eyes, the crow, people know exactly what it is. It's funny, not funny, haha funny, but it's funny how certain things transcend a movie. People who have never seen the crow know that it's the crow makeup. You know, it's like the Scream mask meant nothing when Scream came out. Now the Scream mask is everywhere. It's made fun of. It's in everything.
Right, like every 6-year-old wears it. Halloween,
right? Yeah. I mean, Haley's walked around with a Scream mask on before. I mean, she thinks it's kind of tame because there's no blood or guts are coming out of it, whatever, you know. She's like working on one. Can we have one where the eye hangs out? I'm like, yeah, okay, we'll work on that, kiddo. Like bungee cording it. Well, no, actually, when he was a bungee cord, you would do exactly, you do a movie prop. For those of you who know, you take a condom, you cut that up, and you put it on. That makes the tent looks real, and it doesn't come off. Anyway, so the crow leads Eric to Tintin, whom Eric stabs to death. So this is the scene. Tintin's in the pawn shop,
right?
And he's having the conversation, right? And he goes, "There's still blood on the handle." So you realize that Tintin, again, he's the first guy, and he's got his knives and whatever. That's what he's known for. And you're like, okay, this guy, out of all the gang, he looks like he's probably the most serious one of them.
Well, yeah, but again, we haven't really had to.
In the flashbacks, you see him like, yeah, kind of the other people are kind of tweaky and whatever. He looks like probably the most one who's got his head on, like he's not as high as everybody else, but he looks like the guy who probably does a lot of the wet work.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So then he tries to kill Eric. He's throwing knives at him. And so those are not real knives or props, but they're still being thrown and you still have to knock them out of the way. And that was the whole idea when they're doing this, was that Brandon Lee's like, well, I can knock these things down. I can do this. And they're like, you can? He goes, oh yeah. Because again, he's trained in Jeet Kune Do, which is what Bruce Lee, you know, founded. And it's just like, you're watching this going, he's thinking, oh, try harder, try like hard. And he's like, okay, what is like, he's really, and it's like, this guy obviously doesn't know that obviously Eric Draven is who he is. And then he starts realizing, oh man, this guy, you killed this guy. He's dead. And then what happens is he sticks, what is it? He put a knife in every major organ. And then, of course, he puts the gasoline on the ground, and that's when he lights it on fire. And you get the crow. And what does he say? He goes, I think you would write this up as graffiti kind of thing, right? That's the whole point. It's like that image of the crow burning with him standing and the crow on fire. That is another super iconic image. And it's just super simple. It's not like it's a fully detailed whatever. It's just, but it's done with real fire and gasoline and whatever. And so, so after he kills Tintin, he goes to the pawn shop, where Tintin has pawned Shelley's engagement ring.
Yeah. And the guy there is, that's Gideon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's a face.
He's another,
you've seen
many
times.
Mm-hmm. And so now he goes through all the engagement rings, and as he's sitting there going, nope. And I'm like, and it's each one of those, you know, and he says this, he goes, every one of these is a shattered dream, is a lost life. Like it's a law. And it's like there's so many little things that are said, especially like not the banter back and forth is one thing, 'cause there's some great lines, but the stuff, anything that Brandon Lee says in this movie, almost every single one of those lines is delivered completely. It's different than how everyone speaks. So when he says them, and some of the stuff he says is really poignant, so the writers obviously were working with James O'Barr's original and then the two screenwriters. They knew that don't just have him say any old crap. Have him say stuff that means stuff. He doesn't go on giant soliloquies. He doesn't run off the mouth. It makes what he says important. If you say everything, if everything is said in a normal voice and what you're saying is contrite and to the point, it becomes more important. If you're yelling and screaming the whole time, like it doesn't mean as much. Very much like pro wrestling would teach us. So he finds the ring, and of course it brings back the memories, and he puts the ring. Now the ring's around his neck on his necklace, which became super big thing to wear. A lot of people wore it. I wore a black rope around my neck with a ring on it for years. It's same look. And then is that gas I smell? Takes all of the.
Right. This is where I didn't understand why he did this. The pawnbroker is just doing his job. And then he goes in and there's no animosity. But then when he's found the ring, he's taking his revenge at this point out on the pawnbroker.
But the thing is, so here's Tintin coming in. This guy he knows he's taking stolen goods in. So he's not doing the right thing. The whole point is he's part of the thing with the overall arc of when you're trying to clean that out of the city, you're trying to teach, it's not Batman, kind of thing, but he's trying to get rid of this element that's doing this. So, but he doesn't shoot him. He doesn't kill him. He leads him alive to go tell them, but that's the point. He blows up the pawn shop,
right?
Because he loads all the extra engagement rings into a shotgun, and he goes, "Is that gasoline I smell?" And then shoots it in there, and it just, what a way to instead of just like he could have just set fire to it or whatever. No, I'm going to shoot it with a gun full of rings, and it sets off the explosion. Where are we here? Sorry, recovers the ring. Okay, but spares Gideon so he can tell top dollar's men that Eric is coming for them. Albrecht begins investigating the apparent vigilante disturbances while Eric finds Funboy taking drugs while Sarah's estranged drug-addicted mother, Darla. Okay, so that's the scene we have where you have the interaction right before this with Sarah and Albrecht when they're eating the hot dogs, right? She goes, and he's like, oh, you put it on wrong. He's like, and it's like the scene goes on a little bit and you're like, this is weird, but you have to establish that he's somebody who knows all the people who live on the streets. Whoever he's not above them. He's a cop who's a beat cop.
Yeah, well, you have to remember after the fire, he takes the Sarah under his wing, and for the because she's abandoned.
Yeah,
and so that relationship, as the movie goes on, you realize that he's kept in touch with her.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, but we have to get that because he goes from being the guy who's there and a year later. So now over that year, he's been looking out for Sarah.
And yet he's the policeman that's being vilified time and time again. You don't know what you're doing. You used to be a detective. Now you're just a
beat cop. Yeah. Well, that's what that winds up. He taught, and that's what winds up happening is you start seeing him get yanked down.
Right.
Right. And they never say it outright, but you have a crime syndicate that's occurring in your city and you all know who's doing it. And I feel it's very much like what's who do you call his line in The Untouchables, Sean Connery? Everyone knows where the liquor is. You just go out, reach out and get it kind of thing. Right. They just have to go get it. Like, it's not like no one knows that Top Dollar is doing this, but the police aren't stopping Top Dollar, and anyone who seems to want to question gets killed or brought down. Or so it's, and that's all Albrecht's trying to do is stop this from happening. So the hot dog scene is funny, because she doesn't want onions on hers, right? Kind of thing, right? And but that leads to now she goes to the bar, and Darla is like messing around with Fun Boy, and she tries to get around. She goes, "I already had dinner. The police bought me dinner," right, kind of thing. And they go up to the room, and the bartender, who's like, "Nothing I can do. She's off duty." So now Darla goes up to go get high with Fun Boy. And you're like, this is like, see, we as a certain different generations, I should say, kind of thing, because we are different generations here, look at this and you're like, okay, it's infuriating to us. It's literally infuriating watching this happen. And it should make you mad. I don't care how old you are. But nowadays, some people are like, well, you know, she's got a prop. Nope. Right? Like, you are not to read this as, well, let's feel bad. You are not to feel bad for Darla. Darla is not the one you're supposed to feel. You're supposed to feel bad for Sarah, who's the child who has done nothing wrong, who is skateboarding on the streets in the middle of, like, the worst thing in the world. Like, that's who you're supposed to feel bad for. Don't feel bad for Darla. She's not who you're supposed to feel bad for. Right? That she gets her redemption in a minute. We'll get to that. So obviously they go up there, and then he comes in the window, and he shoots him through the hand. And then you watch the hand close back up, and you're like, okay, like, so that is very, you know, obviously to make it look like, you know, like then he says, stop me if you heard this one. You know, the innkeeper goes, I hand the innkeeper 3 nails. Can you put me up for the night? And he shoots a hole in his hand. Like, it's very, you know, playing off of the idea of the Messiah and the whole nine kind of thing, whatever, because he's bringing redemption there. Now he's there that's not his job. He's not there to redeem their souls. He's there to punish those who have wronged him. But what does he do? He takes Fun Boy, and so Darla runs to the bath. He takes Fun Boy, and he ends up shooting himself in the leg. He puts him in the shower, wakes him up, and then gives him a fatal overdose. She shoves all the needles in him, puts in the shape of the crow, takes Darla to the mirror and squeezes her arm. And she's squeezing the morphine out of her arm. And he says, you know, mother is a name for love on the lips and child, on the lips of all children. And I'm like, again, freaking A, really? That's like the, like this huge important line. He doesn't say a ton, but he gives her redemption there. So even though that's not his job, he's given her a chance to redeem herself, which is the next scene we see after she runs out, right? The next morning, she's making eggs.
See, and now, in a lot of this movie, he's the avenging angel. With the Darla, he's the guardian angel.
Sarah, he's her guardian angel. He's Sarah's guardian angel. So he gives the mother redemption to give her back what she needs. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. But the problem is, in The Crow, he's not there to do that.
Right.
And he gets weakened every time he does something he's not supposed to do. So he's not, he's there to wrong to right the wrongs. He's not there to save Darla. He's not there to save Sarah. This is why he's losing his power that way. He's there to do a job. And that is one of the big things that people have said, like, well, that's one of the differences in the book and the movie. And people have said, well, you know, they didn't do that. I'm like, well, here's the problem. If he kills, he can't kill Darla, but he lets her still be a drug addict. How has he helped Sarah? And his entire thing is that that Shelley was like, and him were the de facto parents of this child, and he would want to protect her as well. It just comes off, you know, I think it plays better. This is where I sometimes, and no offense to the James O'Barr's book, but I think this is where this sometimes plays a little better. This plays more cinematically what you need on the screen.
Yeah.
You need it.
Well, there. You can visually see it. I mean, by him squeezing her arm
and pushing the morphine up her arm.
It's like changing water into wine.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot in this movie where you would see, you know, where are we here? Okay. So, and then telling her Sarah needs her. So she goes, and that's the next. So Eric visits Albrecht. We say, you still have your hat on. He has, he's down to his underwear and his t-shirt, and he drops his beard and he's still got his hat on. And confirms that his suspicions regarding the Vigilante identity. Albrecht tells Eric that he stayed with Shelley while she died, witnessing 30 hours of suffering she experienced. So Eric touches Albrecht, absorbing the pain that Shelley felt, which is a very hard scene too. Later, Eric's, so after that, so he leaves. He goes, like, you know, I disappear again. He thought I'd walk out your front door. Just little lines that, you know, people have forgotten, but are good. So then he's on the street and the car almost runs Sarah down. He grabs Sarah and pulls her back. And she goes, "Get off me. I could have made it. I'm fine." Like, she's got to be tougher and everything. And he just goes, "Well, can't rain all the time," which is from one of his songs, which is how she now knows. Well, this is the problem, is that once Sarah finds out it's Eric, now she wants Eric back. She wants him back. She wants Shelley back. Like, this is where this movie gets real hard, because now, where are we here? Revealing that he's, okay. Eric next targets T-Bird, killing him with an explosion. So that's when they go get road beers. So Haley has not seen The Crow, but I say, we're going inside. Haley goes, yeah, for road beers. She knows that line, because I've said to her before, because we'll stop at like the gas station, like when we're driving up the order. I go, we're going to get, you know, because the gas stations, unless you're getting gas, they really don't like you going to pee unless you're going to buy something. So we're going to go buy like a soda or something like that, whatever, right? So I go, let's get, we're going inside, and Haley has in the past yelled, yeah, for road beers. And Kelly's just like, you don't even know what that's from. And I go, Kelly, you don't know what it's from. And she's seen The Crow. But they go in, and that's when he gets in T-Bird's car. And they're flying by, and they're playing, and that's when he trusts him. And T-Bird now is like, now starts knowing, he goes, you're dead. You don't, there's no coming back in the really real world. Like, there's all these things, you can't come back, but he's back, and now you're going to pay for it. And so he loads him up, and then he shoots the car, which is a real car being shot into, and he blow it up for real. You know, that's, it's just, physical effects always look better than digital effects. And some of the physical effects in this movie, while old, I understand it's like 30 years ago, still hold up even in 4K and stuff like that, because just they look great.
Yeah, now this is the third guy of the four man gang.
Yeah. The following morning, Sarah and Darla reconcile. This is when she's making a breakfast. Sarah reunites with Eric at his apartment. And she knew it was you, kind of thing, whatever. And the lines from one of your songs, and it's hard because he's not supposed to be there for her. He's supposed to be there to avenge Shelley. But at the same time, he's doing the right thing. That is why this people have connected with this so well, because he's not just, he's an avenging angel. He's now also doing the right thing. Top Dollar holds a meeting and his associates to discuss his plans to burn the city to the ground on Devil's Night. Eric arrives for Skank, but that's when the gunfight erupts, ending with Eric throwing Skank out the window to his death. All right. That gunfight is, again, it was very famous, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, this was, again, I had not seen The Crow in probably since it came out on VHS. So
probably 96.
90, yeah. Yeah. And so, well, I'm watching this thing and all of a sudden, a Peckinpah movie breaks out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean... This is Peckinpah at the ultimate.
Yep. Yep. And I think they have to do that. They have to show. So remember what Kevin McTierney always said about the scene in Predator when Mac opens up with the minigun and they all open up with it. And they're like, people are like, but it's too much. He goes, it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be excess. You need to have excess at this point. It can't just be Top Dollar shooting him. It can't just be one person shooting him. It has to be everyone shooting him, because he has killed all of your gang. Your whole gang's now dead. So the rest of the bosses and all the gangs are there. We got to kill this guy. So they go and they're going to kill him. And well, there's nothing that exceeds more than excess. And that scene is super famous, obviously. Just him sitting at the end, when he's sitting in the chair with his hands like that, that's the shot that's on all the posters and stuff. And people are like, yeah, I mean, because it totally encapsulates, but it shows you how skinny Brandon Lee was. He was so painfully thin. Right. People don't see problems. People think of action heroes, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, whatever. Even up to this point, that's what action heroes looked like. Bruce Willis was the exception from Die Hard, because he kind of looked like a normal human being. Yeah. But even then, Bruce Willis was kind of like, but most people, you know, they don't, depending on your age, you don't remember Bruce Lee. He didn't make hundreds of movies. He only made a handful of movies. Bruce Lee was a skinny little guy.
Right.
Right. So you realize that, like, but Bruce Lee was one of the most dangerous men ever. Like, what he could do with his body, you're like, oh, okay. You know, kind of thing. Like, so Brandon Lee, again, trained in Jeet Kune Do, whatever. He was not this hulking, like, he didn't look like Dolph Lundgren. He didn't look like the guys like that. He looked like kind of like a guy.
Yeah. But again, he's in these over clothes all the time. I mean, he's wearing a bulky.
Right. But he takes the jacket off there and you just see him in just the crow, like just in the skinny black pants. He's so, you're like, wow, this guy's really skinny.
Yeah.
He looks almost skeletal, which is what they were going for. They're giving you this guy. How is this guy killing all these top killers? How is he killing these people? How is he not dying? Because he's a skinny little guy. But that's the thing is, that's one of the, it's what makes the dichotomy of what you're seeing so much more poignant there. Throws him out the window. Okay, Top Dollar, his lover, his half, is also his half-sister, Mika, and his right-hand man, Grange, which is Tony Todd, escape. Mika correctly hypothesizes that a crow is the source of his immortality, which is what they go with in the movie. Satisfied with his vengeance, Eric's gift to Shelley, he gifts Shelley's engagement ring to Sarah and then returns to the grave. Grange abducts Sarah as she's walking home and takes her to an abandoned church with Mika and Top Dollar, who then take Shelley's ring. Eric is alerted to the plight by his crow and rushes to rescue her. Now, this is where people have a problem. He's done. This is like, well, we better not have his powers. Because if he still has all his powers, that's a problem, because he's now not avenging Shelley anymore. He's killed all those people. But he's ambushed by Grunge, who wounds the crow, rendering Eric vulnerable. Now, they had to make the crow itself the symbolic of his power, because if they don't, now it's like, well, who cares if the crow's dead? It doesn't matter. He's has no powers. Now he's just a guy, right? Kind of thing, right? Attempted to take the crow for its Albrecht arrives and kills Grange while Mika attempts to take the crow for its immortality. It claws out her eyes, causing her to fall to her death to the bell and the bell tower. Top Dollar retreats to the curb, the church roof with Sarah, where he fights the badly wounded Eric. Eric transfers Shelley's pain into Top Dollar, causing him to stumble off the roof and impaled in the gargoyle himself. Okay, so that scene, McFarlane made a toy of this. Top Dollar, it's a roof. It's Top Dollar with the sword, and it's Eric with the pyre. Yeah. What a great scene! Just the backdrop, and I know that's a painting, and like it just looks cool, and like, but this is what they. This is why they got Michael Wincott to play Top Dollar. This is what he's here for. This, like, he's here for all his little quips and one-liners, and like the way he talks, and like, you know, that's what he's here for. You don't need. So like, remember in in Daredevil, the movie, where they, or even the TV show, right? Kind of thing. Kingpin's always a huge guy. Mm-hmm. Top Dollar's not. He's a skinny little guy, but he controls all this in Detroit, right? So you need him to kind of be a skinny little guy, right? Kind of thing. But he's a killer. I mean, he's killed more people in this movie than anyone else. And, you know, on the roof. And it's great that Eric, because you could have Eric like hit him with the thing and whatever. No. The idea is that I'm giving you all this pain. I don't want this anymore. And gave him all of Shelley's 30 hours of pain. And you're like, well, yeah, that's exactly what you should do. Because you aren't immortal anymore. You're going to go back in the ground and just go back to being dead. But like, you don't need to carry that with you. The crow is there to give you a chance to avenge it so you can cross over. That's the whole point of this movie.
Right.
And he needs to cross over until he can never cross over until he's let go of it. Because once they brought him back, he's now absorbed all this. He has to let it all go. Sarah and the wounded Albrecht are recovered from the church, while a pained Eric goes to Shelley's grave, where where her spirit arrives to comfort him, and his body return to rest. Sometime later, Sarah visits the graves, and the crow returns with Shelley's ring for her, which is, of course, you know, people at the end are like, oh my God, of course you have the ring. Like, well, yeah, but that's what the whole point of it is, so she can have it with him. And the Sarah is the voice you hear at the end, you know, because Sarah's the voice in the beginning.
Right.
It's just, the movie is more than the sum of its parts at times for what it means, but the movie's so good that it's hard to like find fault. People will pick it apart and go, oh, this isn't right. And is it the book? Nope. But it's not supposed to be the book. I think that's one of the main parts of it. It's close enough to The Crow, the James O'Barr's The Crow, that people who love the actual graphic novel don't feel cheated by this movie. It's not like when people look at like the book The Shining and the movie The Shining. People feel that it's not even like, I mean, yeah. But one of them is a Stanley Kubrick movie and the other is a Stephen King book. Like, we got some strong opinions on both sides of this. It's not like you had the same person. It's not like Stephen King made the movie. And Kubrick ripped up the screen, but he did, I'm doing my own. It's a different world. Here, I think what happens is we get enough tribute to what The Crow really is. We build the legend more. And I think it's hard for a movie that is this well, it was well received, but I think since the movie's so well remembered and like, and it became such a cult movie and even now an iconic movie, that it's hard to kind of look at it the way we would have, you know, 30 years ago. When it first came out, it would have been hard to look at it that way. When I first saw this movie, it blew me away. And I'm like, and that was, you know, 28, 29 years ago. And I'm like, okay. And it's still, to this day, I watched it again. It still holds power. And why? Why does it hold? Because the story's solid. The acting is good. I mean, you know, you can say like, well, these aren't the best. You believe every single person is the person they put on the screen.
Right. You don't.
There's no one in there who's hamming it up.
Right.
Yeah. You believe that they're like, people are like, well, but like, I'm like, the guy's a drug addict. Like, he should act this way. Skank's a tweaker. Like, you know, like Top Dollar is that, like, they are 100%. The characters don't come. People don't come in and out of character. There's just character. This is actually exactly what you should have in movies. There is no Deadpool turn and wink to the camera. There is none of that stuff. This movie is not, it's not funny. It's not supposed to be lighthearted. It's not supposed to be dark and grimy and dirty, but the story is not supposed to make you so depressed that you can't live. It's supposed to be a story of redemption. And that's what it is. And it's just hard because nowadays we talk about this all the time. If movies don't change your life, not everything needs to do that. That's why this movie holds up. That's why this movie is still beloved by my whole generation. Like, millennials love it. Like, it's become something that even the newer generation kind of thing look at it and they're like, well, I don't understand all this. Well, yeah, because you don't know a time when there wasn't a cell phone and a whatever.
Right.
But this tells a very specific time when this movie's made.
Right. And the thing is, this is not a watch it one time and we have a discussion like this.
Yeah.
Because it's too... There's too much involved in the movie.
Yep.
And when you watch it a second time, like I will now watch it again, because when I watch the movies for our
podcast, it critically.
I'm stopping in this. I will now watch this completely through.
Yep.
And I'm sure that I will be able to visualize and see some of the nuances that are in the script that you just don't see.
Yeah.
Now, I do have one question, and maybe you can answer this. There are two graves side by side that are completely entombed and what have you. Albrecht, when he finally realizes that Craven is the Crow, he then goes, and there's a scene where he goes to the gravesite and he sees that Craven's grave has been up, you know,
unturned. It's unturned.
It's a graveyard. Why wouldn't other people have seen that the grave has been?
So I think what that is implying is that all this happens in a very short time. This all happens over the course of like one or two nights, and that most people there don't care. There's, you know, Shelley's grave and Eric's grave is only visited by Sarah, right? Who didn't go at that time. And then when she goes later, she's this kind of thing, right? The whole idea is that she's there in the beginning and then the crow's pecking on it. She's there. She doesn't go back to the grave again.
Right.
So, but this all happens it feels like it should be longer, but this is all happening in the course of one night or like maybe 24 hours. Remember, it's Devil's Night. The whole point is it's the night before Devil's Night leading into Devil's Night.
Yes.
That's the whole point. So that I think the thing is that it's just that most people just don't care. There's not someplace people would go or care about. You have to kind of accept that though, that this grave would be.
No, I could understand it, but remember,
you also are in a city where there's so much crime. Would there not be people robbing graves?
I understand.
So,
but Sergeant Albrecht, they may make a specific point of him going to the grave to see the two tombstones, and then he finds the grave empty. That it, yeah. all the dirt is all over right. the place.
Well, that's how he figures out it's there.
Yeah, but the thing is, at the end of the movie, when you go back, the graves are all complete again. And so that's the only scene I don't think they needed in the movie.
Well, no, they need him back in the grave to show that he's
No, I know they need him back in the grave. But did they need to show the grave being dug up?
Yeah, oh no, I think they do. I think they have to show you that there's so much pain and anguish that when he's coming out of the ground, when he digs himself out of the ground, it's a zombie. Well, no, it's pain is making him come out of there.
Okay, but yeah. I mean, that you have to accept. That was the only thing that I have had a bigger question on, as to why do you show a grave that has been dug up? Because it's not dug up. In reality, it's still
dug out. Well, no, it's dug out. He dug out. It's out. He pushes the grave. He digs himself out of the grave.
So that actually happens.
Yeah, but that's when the crow's tapping and then Sarah leaves, then you see, but Eric's screaming as he's coming. They don't show you like a scene of it. They show it in flashes as he's reliving, getting shot and getting killed. His pain is causing him to drive forward. That's what I think.
Right, that's why I need to watch it again. But again, that was the only thing I needed clarification
on. Yeah. All right, so as I said, the Crow, original soundtrack, the original soundtrack with the music in the background and stuff, that's one thing. But the actual soundtrack for The Crow, which was literally one of this thing sold so many copies. The album itself sold so many copies. The main song is The Cure's theme, Burn, became the main theme of the movie. That thing was huge. The Jesus and Mary Chain, Rage Against the Machine, Helmet, all on this thing. The ones that most people remember are Nine Inch Nails did a cover of Joy Division's Dead Souls. You have Rollins Band doing a cover of The Suicide's Ghost Rider. You have Pantera doing Poison Ideas, The Badge. Like, this was heavy metal. Like, these were no joke. Now, The Cure's not heavy metal. Some people are going to say, The Cure's not heavy metal. I know The Cure's not heavy metal. Calm it down. But these were no joke. Like, Nine Inch Nails, Pantera, Rollins Band, The Cure, Jesus and Mary Chain. Like, I mean, you are getting heavy hitters. Singles did this. Singles went and got Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam. And, I mean, Chris Cornell's in the friggin' movie. And they had Smashing Pumpkins and they had Screaming Trees. Like, but that was grunge. That was the grunge scene. And this soundtrack hit. And people were like, yes. And people bought, I mean, everyone I knew had this on tape. And then on CD. And now it's digital, right? Kind of thing. Like, everyone had the soundtrack. The song, the song Burn by The Cure, lit that and Nine Inch Nails' cover of Dead Souls. Those are, they get stuck in my head. And they will live in my head for weeks and weeks and weeks. I can't get them out. Because they're just so good. And it's one of those things that I don't have to even see the movie to get it. If I just hear a clip of it, my brain immediately does the whole song and I get stuck in your head.
Yeah.
So
no kidding.
Yeah, well, no, but that's what wants to happen.
That happens with the stupid commercials. Yeah.
Well, and then the thing is the bands, Medicine and My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, who has another great song. They have After the Flesh. They're the ones, they're performing their song on the stage when they go through, when Skank goes through the glass, he lands on them. That's what it does. But yeah. So, folks, yeah, like, so this movie, obviously, you can see this, you can buy it digitally, it's on Blu-ray, it's on DVD, so, you know, there's a special 4K steelbook, which is more than, you know, just phenomenal stuff, so, you know, obviously, Dad's gonna go back and watch it again. I've seen this movie over and over again. It's a movie that I love watching. It's just a hard movie, I think, right now, sometimes for, like, Haley's seen some of it. Kelly and I've watched together, but Haley, it's hard for her, because this is not, you know, it's a different time. I mean, not that she wouldn't like it, but I think it's just got to get her to like sit down and watch something at, you know, being a teenager, sometimes a little harder. She's not quite ready and always tough for that stuff. But anyway, folks, so, yeah, we like, thank you guys for coming and being supportive of us. Obviously this is our early October episode. this Halloween that the aforementioned Haley will be with me as we talk about the Halloween that almost wasn't from 1979, celebrating its 45th anniversary. Dad will be back in November when we talk about Saw from 2004. So you got your homework, start watching them. So like we say here, folks, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
Are you going to take care of Ron Killens?
What kind of disgusting, despicable lack of respect does that Billy What's-His-Name show booking a match for the total package Lex Luger and Super Brawl? Super Saturday? What is it? I don't even know what it's called. What is it called?
Super Brawl Saturday.
Super Brawl Saturday? Can he afford to pay me to wrestle Ron? I don't know. I'm one of the biggest legends and stars ever in this. God! And your t-shirts are too tight too, Billy! And you book a match with me against Ron Killings! Look at me! I'm a total package! I will rip him apart! I'm pissed now!
No, don't you walk away from me, Daniel. Don't you walk away. I'm the one that loves the fans. I'm the one that loves everyone and everything. You're the one that gets up and walks away every single time. You're the coward.
Will you stop?